There were many people that came before Rosa Parks. There were many people that came before Martin Luther King. You may not know their names. That's okay. But they were content to tell stories and be a part of that and start doing their work behind the scenes. Be willing to say, I'm part of something bigger. And so you're not at the center of the story, even if it's a survivor tale.
Welcome to Crossing Face, the largest multi-faith podcast out there. We have a very special guest today. We have Luann Sabatia. I hope I pronounced it right. I don't think I've ever said your last name. Did I say it right?
You're close, Sabatier.
Sabatia. It's French.
Yes.
So I don't have a facility for French. I was lost in New Orleans once, and my sister. I called my sister and she goes, where are you? And I looked at the road and I said, I go, St. Charles and Karen DeLeet. And she goes, Karen DeLay, honey. So ever since then, that's been my it's been there's been a hold on learning French or being able to speak into it. Right. But I hope I didn't butcher it up too much. Like I said, I don't think I've ever said your last name. But why do we have you on? You're an expert in media. You've had a long-standing career in media and storytelling. You have a long-standing background in innovation in freedom of religion, belief, FORB, or what we call IRF, International Religious Freedom. You helped develop the International Religious Freedom Scorecard. You work very, very closely with congressional leaders, IRF summits, USERF, and so I wanted to invite you on to speak specifically about media and FORB and some of the elements going on right now, sort of a status update. Welcome, Luann.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation.
Well, we can kind of dive into it. A lot of times, we talk about media and the importance of media in religious freedom, because if people aren't reporting what's going on, then these incidents of violence or discrimination and all the strata in between don't get noted. And so it's essential that there's sound reporting and journalism and people that know how to report on faith. You got into this, you've been doing this for a long time. What do you see? What's this current status of journalism in freedom of religion belief right now, as you see it?
Okay. Well, in full disclosure, let me back up just a minute and say, I am a storyteller. I'm very capable of penning articles and editing, but I didn't come into this through journalism as the creator. I came into for the first 20 years of my career, journalism of working with and managing entities. So whether they be nonprofit, for-profit, so working with journalists to ensure that the good works they were doing actually see the light of day, that they had an audience, that they could get their paycheck. So the economic, the behind the scenes things. That said, over the years, over 40 years, I've had the really, and I say this not as some trite thing, the privilege to observe, learn from, rub shoulders with some of the best, whether they're opinion journalists, hard-nosed reporters, or human interest opinion writers, because there's so many types of journalism. To your point, about a decade ago, because of a pivot in my career, I started working with more faith-based clients. Always had a segment of them as part of our client base in our publishing consultancy, but a real intentional move to work with freedom of religion or belief. So to your point, I've not always been a student of journalism and how faith has been reported and persecution and suffering globally. But that said, that's a long lead into the question, isn't it?
Well, but you know, I you see, this is the thing. You're so humble. You know, you just produced a 25 years after IRFA. You know, you've got your hands in the stuff, and the media element is,
But
journalism
I'm
is a
gonna,
part of that. But you know, I know
I'm
you
gonna get to
know.
the
So
meat now. I'm gonna get to the meat. My
I know.
son always said, "Mom, you're leading," and he is a journalist. He goes, "Your leading is so long, always." You know, some observations right now. Look, let's look at this in let's do some building blocks. So let's look just in general, real quick, media in general. So media, let's set aside faith, set aside international religious freedom, persecution, suffering, genocides. Globally, media is being whipsawed back and forth. And so in terms of the economics of it, it's really important that if they can't pay people, they can't write and sustain and draw talent, and they can't market it, just move it out, just put it on a Facebook page alone. So the over the last 2 decades, there's been dramatic change that's accelerated, and in the last 5 years, and what we've seen, John, in the last 12 months, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the International Herald Tribune, the New York Times, Vibe, Vice, all of them, they're shutting down sites, laying off people, cutting back. So that's the landscape that we're working in. Now let's move to religion in general. They've moved away, they being the media companies, the content owners, the however small or large the establishments, they've moved off of religion a long time ago. God bless the ones that have a dedicated religion and faith. They don't even have staff,
Right,
maybe
reporters. I mean,
journalists.
when someone cuts a budget, they don't cut the sports guy, they cut the religion
No,
reporter, you know, and then they say, you know, you sports guy, go over and maybe you can report on
And
something
but
that
let me
happened.
also say that the reason for that too is not just their hubris or lack of caring. The audience has reportedly said that we don't care about that. Now, do I believe that in totality? No. I think some surveys can be skewed, but they're saying they're playing to a and not just a Western view, but globally, supposedly, unless you're in the underground church, they're saying they're playing more to audiences that aren't really following that in the in their daily dose or their newspapers. So that's religion. Yes, you have Religion News Service, you have Religion News Foundation over them, that is doing good work and picking up more of the yoke. They're shouldering it going forward. All right. Then you've had social media just turn it, and digital and social media be disruptors in this ecosystem. And now you have AI. So
Right.
with AI, them trying to harness that and figure out, just as everybody is, from the government to corporations to individuals, you have journalists and content creators and companies figuring out, ooh, what am I afraid of? What works? What can make me better? You know, how to work with this. That's the environment. So when someone says to me, why don't we get our stories covered more? Or how can we? Oh, let me also say a bright spot has been spot, at least in the US, has been Real Clear Politics, has made a dedicated decision to cover religious freedom issues, not just domestic, but globally in religion, Real Clear Religion. So there's just some shining spots. If that's the world that storytelling and news is faced with, not from the consumer of the content, but from the people putting it out, it requires more skill in how we tell those stories. Also, you have crisis after crisis after crisis. There are 10 genocides supposedly at various stages around the world right now,
Right.
okay? So we're being whipsawed, we're in reaction mode all the time, and it's not one up, but yes, we're looking at the horrible things happening in Ukraine by Russia, but then you you still have Sudan, and you still have things happening
Yemen and
in
Burma
raising
and
their
Myanmar.
ugly hand in
Yeah.
Myanmar. Yeah,
Yes.
so it's complicated, unfortunately, because we have laptops and we have social media. Everyone is a content creator, so there's this wonderful freedom, but we've lost the respect and a little bit of the curiosity of how do I tell that story better? How do I do it so it's not just reporting? Is it strategic reporting? Is not just the cast of thousands, how many clicks and eyeballs? Is it the right? I'd rather have 10 people sometimes reading that story who may pass it along at the State Department or take it to the embassy in Ukraine. So the audience, more intentionality and specificity, and how to break through the clutter and how to share the stories in the news in a way that not only compete, but here's the key thing, John, that ride the wave and make it relevant to what's on the mind of the consumer today. And you can do that. That's a skill. It's not going in with blinders. You can have all the facts. You can be a beautiful wordsmith. But if you're tone deaf and not somehow making people understand why this is important to other elements in their life or happening in the world, chances are you may get that story up, or you can even put it on the ecosystem of Reddit or LinkedIn or TikTok, but it's going to be gone tomorrow. It's forgotten.
Right. Or people
So,
just build a
and it
follower
builds
base of
ego.
themselves, right? They just
Yeah.
build their own follower base and just speak to their echo chamber, right? So that happens too,
Yeah, and
you
I'm
know.
not saying this to say you have to have a college degree in this, but it's just like they say, once Adobe or Illustrator or these tools or iMovie came about, everyone became a videographer, everyone became a designer. You talked it, no, you've got design tools. That does not make you a good designer. The same thing for storytelling.
Right. Well, so when it comes to storytelling, you're a master storyteller. You know, you're sought after within the Forbes community, and you work very, very closely with a lot of the key players. You know, let's unpack some. Well, what is storytelling? Our listeners are global. You know, I have advocacy groups and advocates for communities that are. You know, in the middle of Central Asia, and who listen to the podcast, and then we also have, you know, people here in the United States and all this. But when you say storytelling, and as a storyteller, as a master storyteller, you know, you're able to unpack and distill someone's experience or an occurrence into digestible pieces, right? To build a narrative, to build a community of concern. How do you walk us through, you know, what that is a little bit, and how you do what you do. Because everybody, like you said, everybody has tools, but no one knows exactly how to execute those tools appropriately.
You know, I like to approach it in two ways. And I'm not speaking now to a journalist who is reporting, because when a journalist reports, but then they use that skill, they bring can often bring storytelling into it. But I'm talking about storytelling. It can include journalists, it can include advocates, it can include anybody. I kind of approach it on as what's the end game for telling the story? So before, you know, even as you're saying, I'm going to tell a survivor story, or I'm going to tell the story of what's happening to our ethnic group. I'm going to tell the story about a certain incident
Right.
that happened or an atrocity.
Right. What's the so what and what now?
Yeah,
That's
now
what
the
I've done
thing
in
is,
government relations. I'm a
why
so
do
what,
you
what
want
now
to
guy.
tell the story? Just being clear on that in your own mind, and not that it's calculating, but understanding that there is a point. It's not just to get the facts and it reads well. Where do you want to move it? So I come at it, and and this is part of, I studied online. I didn't study this in school, story-based strategy. And yes, there is an institute that has that. And And they themselves have experts around the world, and they've studied movements. They've studied climate change. They've studied AIDS. They've studied civil rights. And in the movements and the, using a story within a strategy, whatever it is, think about frames, F-R-A-M-E-S, so an acronym, okay? And this is not gimmicky. So first of all, F, framing the issue. So the issue is just not just happened to you. Why did it happen? So understanding, in it's like you have these pieces and then you start pulling them together. So when you're framing an issue, what is the issue? Where does your story fit into it? And so this is like having a little crib sheet. You know, it could be a page, it could be a two or three paragraphs, but really thinking through and honing what is the issue that my story is about? It's not just about me or this atrocity. Sometimes that can bring in some historical facts. What is the issue that we're talking about?
Right.
The other things, three of the five elements you're going to be familiar with. This is the one. Number two is where 99% of people in advocacy or strategic storytelling, they miss it. It's the R. And the R, John, is reframing. So what is the common point that I have with my audience? Keep in mind, I'm trying to influence somebody. Story-based strategy means I'm trying to influence them for something. And so I want to reframe the issue in my audience's mind. But to do that, what's the common thing? Where's our common thing we agree on? We can maybe disagree on 90% of the time, but we can agree on this one point. And it's important to, in your psyche, acknowledge and understand that, because that will come out at some point in the way you tell your story. It gives them grace. You know how people say, I'm not going to compromise. It's why they don't collaborate. We're not talking about compromising. We're talking about one common element, one golden thread, maybe two. What is it in this narrative and story and this issue you're dealing with that the people who will be reading this that you want to change their mind? Maybe you're trying to get them to donate. Maybe you're trying to get them to change a law. Maybe you're trying to get a movement going. What is the one thing that will bring them together? And being intentional about that, and document it, if nothing else, in your own mind. You know, you're not going to like methodically go through these like you're giving a lecture. But understanding, for strategic storytelling, you're going to have to reframe the ways somebody who's your opposition, who's a disagreeer, or who's apathetic, or who's unaware, all of those. You're going to have to reframe what you're talking about in a way that they can grab on it. It's like giving them a lifeline to come into your story. That's missing in most storytelling. And then audience. You know, a lot of times our audiences, it's not the audience of me. It's seeing your issue through the eyes of the person in the front row. You know, the people who would be reading this, and maybe you have just the general public. Well, that's great. Even if it's general public, what does that mean? Usually they don't know, they don't care, or they don't like it. All right. So if I see it through their eyes, how is that going to change and impact my choice of words, my adjectives, giving them just how's that going to change? So being very clear, you can have segments of audiences, but who are you writing for? Maybe sometimes it's an audience of 10. You know, it may be in a bigger sea, but it's 10 people. Then the message. The message has to have a clarity. And the message, sometimes do you ever read just these great stories, but you're, this is again part of that issue. It's like, so what's my takeaway? Think about messages. What's my takeaway here? You know, and so that message out of it can actually extrapolate even into campaign planning for advocacy. You know, what's a two or three? Basically, when I work with somebody and my team, when they're launching a new product, a new initiative, a new company, a new book, we always say, what are you trying to do? For who, and why do they care? Those three things, always. All right, don't overthink it. That's it. Well, that's your message, you know? And then last but not least, and this needs to be done delicately, emotion. You must bring emotion into it. And sometimes think back to the cops who, the 12 cops who were on the beach, who were beheaded, remember, by ISIS in the orange jumpsuits. One image, that image traveled around the world. That one image brought this emotion that was unforgettable, horrific, but unforgettable, that tied you to the story. So the emotion most often can come about through images, but also it can be the emotion coming through in the title for the piece, whether it's journalism, a book. So, but it's interesting. You want to be respectful of emotion. For instance, yesterday, I myself did a podcast with Hannah Rose Thomas, the author of Tears of Gold. And she has taught survivors, women survivors of slavery and sexual things due to freedom from Yazidi, Rohingya, Nigeria, and Ukraine, them to do self-portraits to work through their trauma. And some of them said, I want you to help me paint my tears. That's why she said tears of gold, because gold reminded her of the beauty of, like, the Virgin Mary. And but Hannah, I asked Hannah, and the same thing I'll say to your audience, it's a fine line respecting the art, so and the emotion, so we're true to it and authentic and not manipulating it.
Right. You know, so you don't want to come across as it being contrived to to get a response.
Exactly. You know. And how is it fair and allow, even though they're in such suffering, we owe them dignity. And so emotion, doing that, as you can see, you know, you may have a choice, even if you're an illustrator, a designer, or a reporter, or you're doing a blog post. You've got a choice of, let's say, four photos. You want one that's powerful, that grabs and draws them in, but also which one is true to the story? Do you know what I mean? Which one is going to lead them in, but also in a way that is respectful?
Respectful. So, you know, stirs emotion, but is the emotion is the right emotion, right? It's the emotion that's appropriate to the tone of the article or the cause.
So this sounds really clinical, and it may be at first, but once you get into it, it becomes secondhand, and it's just developing a it's not even a style, but a framework that can allow stories and information that absolutely should be told, can have tremendous influence. Why do you think, on even in the West, in the United States, on congressional hearings, they could easily have everyone just submit a testimony? No, they have them in person. And most often, it's not just their opinions and their academics and think tanks, but there are always stories. And it is the stories sometimes that can convince that legislator or that staff person to remember to want to go the extra mile, to do the hard work, to push something through, or to have difficult conversations. So I think, I guess, to close this piece of what I'm saying is, it's not calculated. It shouldn't be intimidating to anyone. You have an opportunity, yes, through social media and through accessibility of laptops and iPhones and podcasts, to reach people around the world that we could never reach and in numbers we could never reach. My question to all of you is, so what are you doing with that? You have technology, you have access to information, but I don't want to convict people, but I hope they're a little burdened or also extremely intentional about what a privilege it is to bring that to the forefront But when isn't it sad that if it just comes and withers away like a feather, do
I
you
see.
want it to stick?
Yeah, it's interesting because we when I was at the American Islamic Congress, we translated the Montgomery story into Arabic and Farsi, and it was one of these campaigns, so great, right? Where we were had programming all through the MENA region, and people had in English and Arabic, "We shall overcome." Dalia Ziada, who worked for me at the AIC, was one of the organizers of Tahrir Square. We were a core element in and mover in the Arab Spring. But then once the Arab Spring happened, there was the so what now, right? So the problem was we were really good at creating activists, but when it came to people that understood governmental process, which wasn't our area, right? There were supposed to be other people doing that. The Muslim Brotherhood took over, right? And so
Right.
it ended up going in a completely different direction. And so you have this really successful campaign that enforced change or instilled change, that moved towards change. But then there was a missing element, and this is what you're talking about, this idea
Exactly.
of the so what and what now.
And you know, I
How do you
always,
operationalize something? You and I talk
yeah.
about operationalizing change a lot.
I always say to someone, think about the story or the content as a being a journey. So it's not one-off. It's not, I was on a webinar and I did this. I always think and ask clients to think, so after that webinar, where did those ideas go? Did they travel on an audio recording? Did you extract them into a series of social media memes? Were you able to do an op-ed? It's not called repurposing. It's how did you do a campaign? Did it come back in a series of stories? Did it become a program? Everything doesn't have to have a long tail, but most content, it's like a pinprick in the ocean of ideas and a lot of things have merit, John. And
Right.
as you said, movements even ebb and flow. And one of the things, again, I'm going to come back to this, is good journalists do this, but don't put yourself into the story. And so one of the reasons the civil rights movement, the story, there were many people that came before Rosa Parks. There were many people that came before Martin Luther King. You may not know their names. That's okay. But they were content to tell stories and be a part of that and start doing their work behind the scenes. They didn't, and by the way, I'm not saying Rosa Parks inserted herself into the global psyche. It's not like Martin Luther King, but and who was an incredible leader. But be willing to say, I'm part of something bigger. And so you're not at the center of the story, even if it's a survivor tale. Let me give you a perfect example of
Sure.
someone who is an incredible storyteller and has you moved it to advocacy, has been lauded globally, but you still don't feel like she's the center of the story. Nadia Murad. Nadia
Right.
Murad. And excuse me, I forget her married name. She's now married, was one of the thousands of Yazidis that were captured on Mount Sinjar. I believe it was 9 years ago. She was a survivor of sexual slavery. And as many Yazidis find, when they, some of them, many of them are still missing, but when they escaped and they came back and they started these entities, nonprofits or little micro groups. Nadia, I'm not, I don't know if it was she, it was herself intentionally, not just her story, but had a couple people around her who recognized the power of story. And that became part of a movement for the Yazidis, which became Nadia's initiative, a now global nonprofit that is getting a lot of resources after working it and smartly, bringing back to the community, building schools, retraining the women who lost their husbands, the women who have no livelihood. That's part of Forb. It's an
Yeah.
ecosystem. You know, and continuing on, then starting, then looking for justice, working with Amal Clooney, and testifying about the genocides in the, at the world in The Hague and in front of U.S. Congress, and then recognized as the she's a Nobel Peace Laureate in 2018, and she continues today. I opened up my feed, and she was with Secretary Blinken. They asked her to the State Department to give an update on the Yazidis.
Yeah.
Amongst all of that, and it's called Nadia's Initiative. John, I tell you, as somebody been in this field 40 years, you don't get the sense it's about her.
Yeah.
She's allowed them to use her story and her name, but and she's gotten awards. That is storytelling for advocacy at its finest, because they are moving the needle. They did raise awareness, and you don't feel that there's this self-aggrandizement going on.
Yeah. I mean,
and we're all not going to be a Nadia, but I think it's important to we don't have a lot of those stories, John.
Yeah. And this, you know, it's like you said, there's all this, there's, you have the stories, but then you have the way in which to craft it so that there's, so that you can listen and you can get through, you know, what they call in the intelligence industry, they call it chatter, right? Which part of information is important, so you can figure out how to make a decision, right? And so how do you get it out there appropriately? And what I'm hearing from you is, and it's something that you and I both espouse, you know, the idea of serving something larger than yourself, right? There's a cause. And then from the cause, you can integrate these individuals and stories into it in your own way, right? Like you and I, we operationalize things. But with Nadia, she has this, she has a personal story, and then a goal for her community, and then the larger persecuted community. And really, she's done it in a way that's where she hasn't put herself in front of the cause. She hasn't put herself exactly in front of the issue. And so, and I think that's a really important thing, because a lot of people don't want to collaborate. A lot of people want to get their issue, have their issue be the number one issue, right? And really, that only lasts as long as the news cycle lasts.
Well, let's also say not just, yes, separate issues, but let's take the case of Nigeria. You know, you mentioned before we went on live on the podcast, you had recently spoke with former Congressman Wolf, who I, you know, is a good friend and a former colleague. And, you know, we were in Nigeria a decade ago and traveled to 26 states at a time when nobody was talking about Nigeria. So I don't say that to make us look good, but I've been following that for a decade intimately. Yeah. I have never seen, and I'm talking about whether it's a roundtable, working groups, NGOs, individuals coming from the diaspora, I've never seen more information or more reporting. I let me back that up. Yes, the Uyghurs. The Uyghurs are another outstanding case study of doing things right, to advocate in storytelling. But for Nigeria, and you're not always going to get what you want, which right now they're wanting to be redesignate Nigeria as a country of particular concern. There's a call for a special envoy, a state, all things. John, never saw more people reporting, trying to tell stories, never saw more murders, atrocities, injustices happening in that country, which is extremely important to America's foreign policy and national security, in all of Africa.
Yeah.
And I've never seen less collaboration.
Oh,
so sometimes it's within one issue or story, and you want to say, not that we're all going to be part of one happy family, but yeah, there needs to be more of a happy family pulling together.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I do a lot of work. You know, I did a lot of work with a lot of collaborators, and one in particular says, "Well, you know, Tom, when are you going to get involved in Nigeria?" And I said, I talked about the Chickamauga River Basin, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I talked about all this stuff. I go, I'll be honest with you, I don't know who to collaborate with.
Yes.
This is what I said to him. This is a 3-day old conversation. I go, I don't know who to collaborate with. I mean, I said, I know all the players and everything else. And then part of me feels there's so many people working on it. what do you want from, what do you want of me? You know? And I say, like, I don't know. I'm happy to have it on the podcast, talk about it on the podcast, I'm happy to do it. But, you know, where is the coalescing on the issue?
And that's my point. Yeah. My point is not to bash. These are well-intentioned and these are,
some of
them are well-funded. But let's go back to, there is, you know, this tie here to international religious freedom and advocacy as we're talking about media. And so what's happening is all kinds of, and you see one headline that's picked up and traveling, 62,000 Christians killed, the most Christians killed there, you know, not just calling out Christians, but Muslims, but we're just throwing stats out there. And I'd love to see something, whether somebody collaborates some of them together on a good short documentary, on a series of articles. Who's not doing a series of pieces that build, that have contributors, that aren't academic? So it's a complicated issue. Mm-hmm. And you can't tell it all in one news story. But let's pivot one. So that's an example where I think that the storytelling, the reporting, there's more reporting. Is awareness rising? Yes, but just rising awareness from many disparate points doesn't necessarily move the needle.
Well, it goes back to your frame, you know, the idea of, okay, you have an issue, right? So we were going to go back to frame, right? And then you got your reframing, right? Yes. So people are kind of salad barring it. They're stirring some emotion, right? They're throwing out an issue, but they're not taking a cohesive, you know, march on it. And like you said, it doesn't mean that people aren't well-intended. It doesn't mean that there's not a lot of hustle. I get pinged on it all the time. And I just say, look, this is my book right now. I want to be able to contribute and have impact. I want to be able to have the intended result go towards those that are persecuted. So how do I get there? Right. And when it comes to people say, oh, well, you want to come with us on a trip? What you need to do is get over there. And I go, to what end?
You know? Exactly.
You know, so I go, because I do ground assessments all the time, you know, both open and closed, you know, for different organizations, agencies and entities. And that's one of the things that I do is the ground assessment, multi-faith ground assessments. We go out there and do it. And so I go, you know, all the information is exists. What are we doing with it? You know,
let me tell you, I know we talked about the Yazidis, but I would be remiss not to mention the Uyghurs. So yes, it's China, but that's not the reason that this has the heightened awareness. For a decade, there have been a couple small NGOs, and they're still small, Uyghur Human Rights.
You know, working project, really hard.
UHRP and Uyghur, there's a couple of them. They have been masterful using data, using stories in a respectful, emotional, memorable way, tying it to not just the Uyghurs. This is part of eradication in Xinjiang, which is China. China, one of the superpowers, the governments in the world, keeping that tie to national security, which is really critical for the legislative piece. And each step, what they've done too, they have broadened their coalition. So there's many groups advocating for Uyghur, but now not just Uyghur, Asians, they're bringing it there. The Uyghurs, they've had a couple wins under their belt. A win, I mean, look, I say that very respectful. A win is only if the Uyghurs would, the suffering and persecution would stop and the 2 million people would be released from camps. All right.
Sure.
But what I'm talking about is the Uyghur Labor Act and just monumental, number one, to get something passed through Congress, but with the Uyghurs and with bipartisan, incredible number of legislators signing on. But now they're saying, Taiwan, Hong Kong, how can we help you?
Right.
And they don't feel that diminishes their impact. Let me tell you something else they've been able to do. They take information and, for instance, something was leaked, some hacked data that showed, and this was from a think tank, that showed the actual names and case studies. Well, what they did recently is they went and said, oh, it's interesting. Nobody's ever looked at Uyghur and women. And they looked at the data, a subset of women. They did a small 15-page report. They didn't overgrandize it. They dimensioned it. And so what I'm saying is somebody who maybe was following Uyghurs, but maybe they work on women and human rights or now you've got their attention. Yeah. They're masterful at pulling out something that's going to get the attention of the legislator, all in how the story and their testimonies have been told over a decade. So, you know, that is definitely a genocide. And so when I say masterful, they have not always had a lot of money, but they have worked smart
Well, taking information that already exists and looking at it from a different beach of the pond, that with an issue that's very relevant, right? So gender and faith. Masterful is the word, right? So you're not reinventing the wheel. You're not saying we are going to get our own data. You're saying we're going to take a look at this, and whatever the results are, the results are. But that's, you know, because that's one of my three pillars that is data, right? Bringing data to and getting away from the anecdotal stuff. The storytelling is good. I'm not saying that's not, but making sure,
people say, and I hear this outside of the Forbes space or religious freedom space all the time, you know, I'm careful to say, I don't call it best practice or a best case scenario, but they have done it with excellence. And I think there's things we can learn from because they didn't have a lot of money. They're not a big group. Now they have more and more, but they don't have huge staffs. You know, it's just not just about working hard and not just having the information, but how they've used that. At the end of the day, John, it's data. When we look at content, let me just say something. It's going to sound, sure. I hope it's not going to insult you or your listeners.
No, it's okay. It's here.
Let's break down content. Content is data, images, stories, video, illustrations. Okay. So don't confuse the platform of how the content's traveling with what the content, this is what you have to work with.
Right.
And sometimes they can be singular. It can be any of those combinations. And so when we talk, even looking at sometimes storytelling, what's a storytelling strategy? It's not just saying, how do we frame the story? My point is, where are you moving it out and why? It could be that a podcast is only a certain segment of audience. And so that content there, you're not going to put the same content in every distribution point or for every audience. It doesn't work.
Well, the durability, right? The transferability of something, right? Yes. So, you know, and this is the innovation of what you just said, at least from my perspective, right? And so you were talking about the Uyghurs. They're subject matter experts in genocide, right? So now, they're subject matter experts in a lot of different things, but their expertise is durable and transferable. So then they can get into the Taiwan issue. They can get into the Rohingya issue. They can get into these different issues. And it elevates their cause, but it also demonstrates their subject matter expertise and keeps them relevant in the news cycle or with different agencies that are working. And then they become a trusted partner and the community is concerned around their community.
Let me tell you. Yeah, absolutely. And let me share with you, you know, you had mentioned that one of the projects that was a tremendous amount of work, but my colleague Aaron Rodenwald and I had written the 20th retrospective of the Religious Freedom Act in America, and that involved lots of interviews, and we've just updated it for the 25th. This is very telling. One of the interviews among, I think we did 75 this time, was Mariah Mercer. And it's in the retrospective, was Mariah Mercer, Deputy Director of International Religious Freedom and under Ambassador Hussein in the State Department. And Mariah, by the way, in a prior career before government, was a journalist. And I said to Mariah, where are you concerned about or investing look going forward in terms of religious freedom and the issues and the advocacy? And she said, well, you know, there's many areas we're working on. And like Dan Nadel said, we take the long game. But she said, we've started training programs in countries around the world for journalists on how they tell that story, on how they report stories for impact. This is the US government recognizing not just they're doing it, they're funding it. That not the stories that they want the way they want it, but they realize this critical missing piece. And we're talking about not just in the West, but in India, in Africa, in the Middle East.
It's one of these things where it's so important that, going back to the beginning of our of the podcast, when we were first chatting about, having the tools doesn't make you a journalist, right? It doesn't make you a content creator. You got to be able to utilize the tools, and for the government, this government, to kind of weigh in on this and to actually start funding programs and conducting the training overseas, where they can actually assist in people getting their stories out, using those tools appropriately, and then plugging into the larger community, where there can be mentorship and there can be the idea where there's they can become better at what they do and get their information out there in a way in which it's compelling, or it could be utilized for, reporting or other reports and so forth, is so important. And so it's an interesting point. We work with the office, and it's not just an office. The Earth Office isn't just something for advocacy. They're actually executing programming on the ground to make something happen that is going for that is for the long game, that ties into all these different communities that need advocacy, need representation, but need to get their stories out there.
I agree. I agree. And I think, also let's not forget, yes, there's citizen journalists and, the availability of, not just mobile and cell phones and burner phones, but one of the biggest movements I'm seeing right now among the NGO community and even some government funding is within local communities around the world. And this is not just for Ford, but also peacekeeping, USAID, the United States Agency on International Development, is providing mechanisms where they can report in, sometimes anonymously, the data and the incidences that are happening on the ground. When we talk about, data, it's really lacking in this field. I'm not just talking about data from a Pew study or something from a think tank,
It's a
but
big issue, yeah.
reporting up because of closed society sometimes, because of who the perpetrator is, sometimes non-state, these things that are happening. But in terms of information sharing, storytelling, journalism, that's a really important piece that they're looking to make it the more credible the information, also, and pointing to sources. I can't tell you how many times I find people not sourcing their information in this sector.
Right. It's anecdotal, which, it can be compelling from a story standpoint, but policy being made from anecdotes and funding being directed because anecdotes is different than it actually being verified information, from hundreds.
Verify and trust,
Trust.
and also doing it in a way that does no harm. The advocacy community always says, do no harm. In other words, when you tell the story, sometimes you don't show the face, sometimes you use a pseudonym. And so understanding not doing harm, But there's still a way to verify it, because if I don't have trust, I'm not going to fund you. If I don't have trust, I may not join your movement. If I don't have trust, I may not introduce that bill into parliament or so forth. So trust, where does trust based on? So anyway, I know we've come full circle, but every day I think of how whoever I'm interacting with in a teaching or consulting or even collaborating mode, how can I help them bridge? We're all trying to bridge to something, John. And content is a piece of that. It's like a ladder. It doesn't, you have to walk it, but it's like a ladder. We have this incredible opportunity to bridge into other groups for purpose and for change. And that shouldn't be a burden, but I want to inspire people to do the hard work.
There's no, and it's a long time coming, because the Pew report is great, but it doesn't cover all, right? And you can and same thing with the Earth reports, and both at USERF and the Earth office. There's the idea of getting of bringing data, being judicious with information is really important. And I think that's kind of, maybe this is, I know we've been talking for a little while, but I think this is a really, aside from the innovation that we were talking about earlier, being judicious about information, being judicious to make sure that the appropriate information is there, it's verifiable, and you can build trust so that you can make confident decisions to direct funding or to address policy. And I think it's such an important element, which is, really the hallmark of this latter part of my career. I've done that in my earlier career, but when it comes to Earth, making sure that we get that information that we need to make the decisions, and if we don't have it, how do we get it? Do you bring an expert in genocide in like the Uyghurs to provide an independent third party assessment about something that's not related to them? And at least you get somebody who's in there, who gets that information, who understands it, and then can turn around and churn it out in a way in which you can say, you want to know what? I think our policy needs to go in this direction or this direction. I think the funding needs to go here. And I think it's just a really important takeaway from your breadth of experience and who you are and the work that you've done.
I'm thinking about I appreciate that, and I'm just thinking about giving people some paths. I would like to leave you and other people saying that.
Well, that was going to be the ask. What if
Well,
your listenership out there
the
is,
ask is, if you want to learn to do this more, they can reach out to me, and or they're I can put them in touch with resources of where can they read about this, where can they learn about this. Even pointing to some of the NGOs doing some good work. So the
we
point,
can put in the notes, the show notes, all
yeah,
so
just
sort of
take a step.
Luann cheat sheet, that sort of thing.
No, but no, not really, but take a step. Just take the first step. This may be a little bit, hopefully it's not overwhelming. I want it to be encouraging, but with a purpose. I'd like to leave you with something that's not really profound, but basically, my thought for the day is, John, words matter.
Yeah, they do. That's something I've heard you say before, and it's and the idea of having, taking time to make sure that your messaging, you're providing that your message is in alignment with what your intended purpose is. And so,
Absolutely.
Luann, I appreciate you taking the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.